I'm Steve from Maryland, the product of numerous surgical procedures, who appreciates fresh straw, some occasional mutton, and often wonders why they can't just leave him alone.
And I'm Al, a Kiwi like Kingston, whose brain can usually be restarted with coffee. But even then, I just end up stumbling into somebody else's bedroom and breaking things. We are Hammerama, the podcast recently thawed from hibernation and at large once more to strike listeners dumb with horror.
Our theme is from the wonderful House of the Gorgon by the equally wonderful Reber Clark. But this month, the wonders don't end there. On this very special episode, we bring actual scholarly wisdom, for once, to our discussion about evil of Frankenstein. Instead of our usual inept waffle, we are joined by a true expert,
Hammer alumnus, combat veteran, friend to the stars, documentary host, and editor and publisher for over half a century of the magnificent Little Shop of Horrors magazine, Mr. Richard Clemenson. Welcome to Hammerama.
Thank you guys for having me. At my age, each day is a pleasure. Any day that I can move around and talk about Hammer, that's even more of a pleasure.
Well, it is so good to have you here, Dick. We've had a few goes at this, and that hasn't been your fault at all. It's been circumstances and general ineptness. However, I'm really excited to be able to talk about Evil of Frankenstein with you and Steve, because I think it's fair to say that this film comes with its own share of baggage in the form of received wisdom. So I'm really looking forward to busting some myths with you, or maybe even confirming some of them.
I do know I have some questions from this movie.
Oh, good.
Yeah, I watched it last night, listening to Constantine Nasser's very well-researched commentary, which he turned into an article in Little Shop of Horrors number 49, which has an Alistair Hughes color cover with it. The Baron swinging through the fires.
It is a wonderful issue, and obviously it addresses a lot of the points that I want to raise. But at this point, I think we'll have a listen to the trailer.
You are interrupting my work.
Your work? The work of the devil?
Hands.
Please, Father. Ah. Luca,
no!
The evil of Frankenstein. The evil of a man who created a monster by crude surgery and harnessed the tempestuous forces of nature to give it life. The evil of Frankenstein unleashed a monster that terrorized a whole community. Peter Cushing as the Baron and Peter Woodthorpe as the ruthless Professor Zoltan, who fought the Baron for control of the monster.
Oh, he'll understand you all right. He just won't obey you. That's all.
Duncan Lamont as the chief of police. Katie Wilde and Sandor Ells as two young people caught up in the evil of Frankenstein.
Get out of his way, you fool!
Baron Frankenstein, Peter Cushing of course, returns to his ancestral home after being exiled many years ago for creating a quite badly made monster. Apparently, the priest-throttling, burgomaster-shoving, hypnotist-slapping, guard-chloroforming Baron is well and truly over people by this stage. He definitely resents having to enlist the services of the seedy mesmerist Zoltan, Peter Woodthorpe, to jumpstart his recently rediscovered creation's inert brain. Given that the monster is being played by a New Zealander, just switching the TV channel to a rugby game might have actually done that. As well as bad anger management, the Baron needs to add gullibility to his list because, to absolutely nobody else's surprise, Zoltan gains control of the creature and sends it on a revenge-fueled killing spree. Will Frankenstein find he's been stitched up? Or will Zoltan's hypno cease forever? Will the beggar girl find happiness with hands? across the water? Or will she continue to give him the silent treatment? And most importantly of all, will people still be talking about this film 60 years later? Well, apparently they are, or we are. So Dick, we'd like to invite you to go first with your initial thoughts about The Evil of Frankenstein.
It's one of the films, the Hammer films. I saw my very first one in 58 or 59, which was The Revenge of Frankenstein and Curse or Night of the Demon. I mean, that's a double feature. We 60, 61, 62, I call out all of them. We moved, lived a long way in theater. I missed all these Hammer films. And finally stumbling on Evil of Frankenstein, and it's very colorful, very beautiful. You got an Academy Award winning cinematographer and director, Freddie Francis.
Yeah.
And at that point, I guess I didn't notice how bad the makeup was. Roy Ash is my friend. It's hard. Hey, Roy, it really stunk. But it didn't stink. It's like Constantine Nasser pointed out when they did Tales of Frankenstein, the abortive Hammer, Columbia TV series, why didn't they use almost the same makeup that was very similar to Universal? But neither here nor there, it's an entertaining film. I really do think someone somewhere at Universal mentioned the Hammer and Anthony Hines that, you know, you really should use a Frankenstein-style creature. There's no doubt that's what they're shooting at. But in the group of all the Hammer Frankenstein films, it's not Horror of Frankenstein, but not Curse of Frankenstein. It's not Revenge of Frankenstein.
Well, I watched it for the first time earlier this week. And I know some people were commenting when we talked about this one being our next one coming up. We had some feedback from people on our Facebook page saying, oh, this is the one that's like Universal and so on. And you can see some similarities between the Universal Frankenstein movies and in this Hammer film. Interesting hybrid, but I also think it stands alone as a Hammer film. So if you're looking for Universal connections, yes, you could find maybe more than it was intended. I know from reading it was a joint Hammer Universal distribution, right?
Universal put up the money, but it was basically a Hammer from start to finish.
Yeah. What I was meaning is that they had some more leeway into leaning into the Universal if they wanted to. And so it's hard for me to tell, was that true or is that people projecting into it? And Mr. Clements, you'd probably be able to answer that more than I will as we go through. But I enjoyed it. I mean, I enjoyed it, but to me, I've only seen four of the Frankenstein movies. The three, including this one that we've covered for Hammerama and the one that Alistair and I covered for Monster Kid Radio, which I believe was the last one, right, Al?
Monster from Hell, Steve.
And a Monster from Hell. And this one, it's called Evil of Frankenstein. Yet Frankenstein is, in my opinion, the least evil person, or one of the least evil, in the movie. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, compared to the main characters. I mean, yes, the beggar girl is definitely probably the least evil of them all. Compared to the first two movies where Frankenstein has evil tendencies, especially the first movie, this one, to me, he's the heroic Peter Cushing Frankenstein compared to the other ones that I've seen. I don't know how you're going to be able to connect this with the continuity of the first two, because it seems like it's his twin brother. The flashback was different than what happened in the prior two movies. So to me, this is like a standalone movie where the Baron is not really a bad guy. I guess you could call him a hero or anti-hero, but he's not a bad guy, in my opinion. And I do have questions I'll bring up later, but I think that's a good starting point. I don't know if either you want to comment on that or not.
Regarding some of the things you've just said, Steve, this is why I take issue when people claim that the Baron, as played by Peter Cushing through all of his films, is a clear evolution of the same character, because I really don't think so. But I have actually mentioned that before, in fact, in our Revenge of Frankenstein episode. But what I'm really interested to hear Dick's views on is this often quoted statement that Evil of Frankenstein is basically a Hammer film in the style of the original Universal horror films.
Hammer, although they could go and try and link each film to the previous one, all their films, unlike Universal released all the Universal films. They released Warner Brothers, Columbia, Universal. Mm-hmm. and then 20th Century Fox, and then Warner Brothers 7 Arts, and then EMI, which was Continental, and finally Paramount. There was no continuity of distribution. They were spread far enough apart where with Universal, again, they were jammed together. It wasn't required, I think, for most viewers to think, oh, what went before? And I think that might have been the case here. They just said, okay, we really don't need to tie in that at the end of Revenge, his brain is in a new body. And he was a nasty piece of work in both of the first two films. I mean, he was killing people so they could reuse parts of their body in Revenge. Evil Frankenstein, all the paperwork, all the people, it's all gone. It's hard to say what they were saying in Hammer House. Gee, should we tie this more into what went with the classic Universal? Because occasionally Jimmy Sanctuary would read the scripts or see the films that Universal made, such as The Mummy. They had a bigger budget. And you can see it in the exterior sets. And that scenes like where the creature's walking down the street at night is almost identical to a scene from Frankenstein Meets the Wolfman walking down the street at night. And I don't think it was intentional. But I don't think Hammer, other than saying, let's kind of copy the makeup, because they had to, someone had to have said that, ever thought that this was following to this type of Universal. This was going to be a Hammer Frankenstein film. This is going to be the Baron. The creature, as always, is going to be secondary. If I have a major gripe with it, sometimes the Baron just sort of fades out of the story too much. There's too much of Zoltan or too much of other stuff. And the Baron is a peripheral character, which he wasn't in the first two films.
It's really interesting that you mentioned that, Dick, because I'm about to give my own first thoughts. And I'm really going to try and explain why I find this film a little bit unsatisfying. I'm guessing this isn't many people's favorite Hammer Frankenstein film. Now, I should be careful when I say that, because I've said things like that before and received a deluge of contradiction on Facebook. But I kind of find it quite unsatisfying, and I'm going to try to explain why. The Baron usually drives the narrative in any Hammer Frankenstein film that I've seen. But here, in this film, it feels as if events drive him. In every other sequel, we discover the Baron already established with a scheme in operation. But here, he is a newcomer who kind of wanders in with no clear plan. And he stumbles from incident to incident until accidentally rediscovering, well, in fact, it's rediscovered by someone else, rediscovering his own monster, and then finally gaining a purpose. Zoltan is well played, but I find him to be a frustrating character because the Baron feels diminished by having to associate with such a tacky huckster, and even more so for apparently trusting him when absolutely nobody else does. Zoltan's intrusion disrupts the entire dynamic, for me, of what a Hammer Frankenstein film usually is, because the Baron's abilities, knowledge, and cunning are always paramount, and that's what makes him Hammer's true indestructible Frankenstein monster, rather than any creature he makes. He should never have to defer to someone else or stand in the background of a scene, and yet that's just exactly what happens in this film. But on the positive side, Katie Wilde's unnamed beggar is an early example of a completely non-sexualized female lead in Hammer. She is dirty, disheveled, and apparently not even desirable enough for the revolting Zoltan. But what she does bring is an actual performance and intriguing character, and not just another objectified starlet. And as I say, I really enjoy her performance. So I guess I'm agreeing with what you've just said, Dick, and that is that at times the Baron seems to fade into the background, and that should never happen in a Hammer Frankenstein film.
Well, you look at the first two, and he's to the forefront. And even though he fades to the background a little bit in Frankenstein Created Woman, it still revolves around him. It's trying to capture the soul. And the girl comes in, and as you had more and more of that period where you had your young love interest, Hammer always threw in, He never faded. And this one, well, it's just like, what do you guys think of the flashback? Apparently in the script, it only ran 2 pages and runs like 6 minutes on the film. And there's no dialogue. And it's just stuck right in the middle there. And nothing much happens. I mean, I understand the reasoning for it, but it just, it seemed to bring the storyline to a crashing halt at that point.
Yeah.
The main value to me of this flashback was only that it sets up this alternative universe version of the Frankenstein history. Like I said, it doesn't go with the first two movies. So if you rely on people that have actually seen the earlier films, then they're going to get thrown off because they know that's not how things went earlier. I do agree, though. It is kind of longer than it needs to be, and it's just not set up well. Maybe it could have been set up when he discovers the creature in the ice, and then he flashes back to what had happened prior. So it fits in it. Maybe they could add it as two separate things. I'm not really sure. It didn't bother me too much, but it does set up how you had the anti-science crowd driving the Baron out from place to place. They're trying to set that up a little bit because the creature really didn't kill anybody in this flashback. It killed, what was it, sheep?
Sheep.
Yeah, sheep.
It killed sheep, and they're shooting the Baron too at the time. They would never have known from this flashback that the Baron and the monster were interrelated at this point. So there's a little plot hole there. If you think about anything in this movie a little too much, it doesn't hold up. You got to let some things go with the flow.
I try and look at this film in the eyes that people saw it when it came out. This was probably come out in 1964. I've always been curious if people went to, did the makeup seem as bad then as it does to us who saw it later in life and could view it? Or the fact that if you look at the first two Frankenstein films, you can sense there's not a lot of money spent there. Hammer didn't have facilities. You look at this, they sold it to Universal for £160,000. That's a lot of money back in 1964. Yeah. And it cost not quite $130,000. And when you think about those back-to-back films came in 65, they worked out like $100,000 each. There was a lot of money spent in this film. The laboratory sets, which was something Freddie Francis, the director, really insisted on, are gorgeous. Ever had a laboratory set up like that any of their other films. It's visually, and the money they'll spend on, just like that huge outdoor set. My gosh, you see all the extras. Oh, and the set compared. The ones that make Universal always seem to have more money, more people involved than just background. And something, too, the Universal films would use night for night shooting, which may not seem much. But you think about The Curse of the Werewolf, if that had been day for night. And it ended up looking like Dracula, Prince of Darkness, where you see the clouds going across and green grass and that. It's a real strength of money spent. But as you guys said, the storyline is based on what I heard, two stories that were written or storylines for the aborted television series. Tales of Frankenstein. To piece together two of those, and it's something they had to have done fast because you had the Gorgon coming up back to back. And Anthony Hines, who wrote the script, Frankenstein, ended up rewriting the script of the Gorgon. So it's like we have to meet a starting date. It has to be finished at such and such a date. It has to be released. Let's go. See if we can taper over the weak points.
I'm aware that I might be coming across as a little bit negative, and that's generally something that we try not to do on Hammerama. Here, every day is Christmas Eve, and we always try hard to find something positive to say about the films that we're discussing. And I will say that what I really do enjoy about that flashback is that incredible laboratory set. I'm a fairly superficial person, and if you show me a little bit of flash and bang, then you've generally got my attention. But what I particularly love about it is just watching Cushing work. He operates that equipment, he moves around that lab as if he has been in that environment most of his life. He knows what every little dial and lever does. He acts as if he's built it himself, he knows it intimately. And the other thing that I really appreciate, I'm always impressed when Hammer manage to organize a well-populated crowd scene. And in the carnival, you really do believe that the entire village has turned out, that it is a community. It feels real. It feels like it extends beyond the edges of the screen. It gives it an authenticity and a touch of class.
You guys are talking about the main lab, which I love. And I agree with you guys. That was the better lab. But I also want to bring up about the earlier lab, the one that they showed. I love that too.
the water whales. Yeah,
I enjoyed that because it just shows you the Baron using the resources around him and how creative and do-it-yourself that he is. It's impressive. His main strength is his determination. It works against him in later movies especially, but in this case, it looks like it's a positive how he's able to reinvent himself and reinvent the labs and make it work. But I love the way that looks. I don't know. I just want to go in there one time and play around and get, you know, just to see it. I mean, that's the one out of the two, that would be the one I would want to play in more as a kid, you know, like just like, oh, I want to get in this one because this seems like something I could build, where the other one's like, I'm never going to have a castle and all this other stuff. But I can do this one. I got a stream nearby. I can make this with a little bit of wood from dad's barn. You know, I could do this and that. I could make this work.
Well, it's interesting. Another reference to the classic Universal, which I just discovered on Constantine Nasser commentary, you get to elect the power off of the lightning rod. Original script, they were going to have kites, the great kites from The Bride of Frankenstein.
Wow.
And it immediately pops up. So that's one, an amazing scene. Somewhere along the line, saw that in The Bride of Frankenstein. I mean, why would you choose kites? But then what they ended up with, because I'm sure it was too elaborate for the special effects. So, that one got a little touch of Bride of Frankenstein to it.
Mary Shelley was famously quite coy in her novel about how the creature was actually brought to life. And I think it was really in the Universal films where they expressively showed it to be electricity in the form of lightning. Now, with Hammer films, I always got the impression that it was more of a biochemical process, something a little bit more mysterious and subtle, except for Evil of Frankenstein, which very clearly goes back to the Universal approach via a lightning storm.
You have to love that scene when they're trying to get the power going and Hans is like pulling the lever and she's over there to help him.
Baron's pushing like crazy.
And then he's pushing the wheel. I mean, you really felt the energy, you know, like not the energy, but the dire need to get this power going. Yeah. I mean, both actors were able to portray that, but especially Peter Cushing, like, we got to do this now. Like, it's almost like we're almost past the time, you know, and you felt that there. I mean, that is just, it's wonderful to watch. And you're just drawn right in because of the two men selling the scene so well. And then they have the priest come in. It's like, oh, you jerk.
Mm-hmm. And the priest is so over the top. Even by older.
Yes, it's me.
I shouldn't get the impression I don't like this. I like all the Hammer Frankenstein.
Same.
I saw Horror of Frankenstein and Stars of Dracula in 1971 at the drive-in in Richmond, Virginia. So I was in with the U.S. Army there. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, these are colorful and pretty entertaining.
Yeah.
There's no huge drop-off in quality of any of the Frankenstein films.
Yeah.
It's a possible exception for because it didn't have Cushing. But I watched Frankenstein and the Monster from Hell because we're covering that in our next issue, Little Shop. What a good little movie.
This brilliant.
Wonderfully directed, and the settings, they had no money to make it with. I just got a copy of the budget. And looking at this budget from 1972, and it was barely the same amount of money they spent in 63 in the Evil of Frankenstein.
Wow.
And I watch Evil, some of the most beautiful setups that Freddie Francis had, the movement of the people within the scene and that. It's so different from Terrence Fisher. Both are exactly right for who they are, but I never saw Fisher do things like that. But I, again, just watched Devil Rides Out because we're covering that issue. Watching how Fisher moves his stuff and the people and such the scene with Okada and the lady when he's hypnotizing her. It's intriguing, two different people approaching the same subjects. Visually, they're different, and visually, they both work.
Little Shop of Horrors, issue 49, actually helped me to appreciate a scene more than I did at the time because it's so subtle, it's almost a subliminal thing. And that is the lighting in the cave set. When the Baron, Hans, and the beggar girl take shelter from the storm, the lighting is bluish, suggesting the electrical storm happening outside. But then when morning arrives and the storm has passed, the colors are warmer, suggesting the dawn light.
And as I say, it didn't necessarily strike me at the time. It registered more on a subliminal level. But it's an almost theatrical touch, and it works extremely well on screen.
Well, when you have Freddie Francis and John Wilcox, who photographed many of these films right up towards the end, apparently they worked together. Well, they were in the Army in World War II on some sort of film unit. And it's just like with Arthur Grant, who... he wasn't Jack Asher, but he was a good lighting cameraman. But when he worked with Freddie Francis, Dracula is Risen from the Grave, it's visually just such a stunning film. And the same thing be said about Evil. I mean, the shadows, the lighting.
Mm.
It's a gorgeous film. I watch it in Blu-ray. And I go, wow, this is really, really attractive.
I really love the matte paintings in that film. And of course, Evil of Frankenstein has its share of impressive matte paintings as well, which I always enjoy seeing. Now, Steve, would you like to talk about your favorite scene?
I'm not sure what you guys are going to pick for yours, but my favorite scene, I have to say, was when the Baron goes to try to get back his belongings from the Burgermeister. And I always do this. I always steal Al's scene. So
you've done it again.
He always lets me go ahead of him. You think he would learn. But nevertheless, he goes back to get the stuff from the Burgermeister, and he gets trapped in the bedroom with the wife. And it is just... Peter Cushing is channeling a little bit of like Earl Flynn with his look and his body language, or not Earl Flynn, Cary Grant. Where it's like a Cary Grant kind of scene where he's in there, he's looking at the woman's looking at him, he's trying to figure out how to get out of this. It's very well done. And the woman is just like, Karen Gardner is just looking at him like, it's like, oh, boy, this is a man. Unlike the thing that she's married to, she's like, this is the guy I want, and I'm already in his bed. So you find out it was one of his belongings, you know, and that kind of stuff. And when he ties and he jumps out the window, and makes his getaway, and the bed slides over. Just her whole body language and looking and longingly at Peter Cushing. I don't think I've ever seen a movie where a female is like just looking that longingly at Peter Cushing. This has got to be the one. He is like the sexiest man alive type thing. But I just love the whole humor. Such a great scene that works so well. And I was happy to see it because it, to me, that just stands out for that. Peter Cushing, the sex symbol. You know, the Baron as being the stud. I was just blown away. It was just fun. What do you guys think?
You just picked my favorite scene, you Bob.
Yeah, all three of us had the same favorite scene.
Several of the lines were ad-lib.
Really?
When he yelled, "Shut up, woman," was ad-lib.
Oh, that's brilliant. Like,
when he's sliding across and ready to tap, what does he say? Good evening, or again, that was ad lib too.
Good evening.
The whole scene was it was Cushing being kind of let go, and it was wonderful. And like Karen Gardner even says the same thing in her interview with Sheep, says, "Ooh, now this is a man. You're looking at
this is a man
with his little hat he's going to wear to keep his head warm." And then Cushing comes in beautifully dressed, and at that period, he was had a guy's wig on. He was a good looking man. It's an amazing bit of acting all the way around by Cushing.
It is, and in fact, in the scenes prior to that with the Burgermeister himself, I was really impressed by Cushing's comedy timing. Because for most of the exchange, he's angry and he's upset, but then he'll suddenly go quiet when he spots something else that the Burgermeister has stolen, and he'll almost do an aside to camera. And when you combine this with his good evening, before he disappears from the balcony in the Burgermeister's bedroom, it just struck me that it was very much like a Roger Moore James Bond film. I could really see Moore's Bond just throwing a quip like that over his shoulder as he exits the scene. But as I say, for most of it, Cushing's Baron is angry. And I don't think we've ever seen him that worked up for such a prolonged period of time. He's angry and he's shouting, and Cushing can shout really well. And yet still punctuate it with some humorous moments, like I really love the "Be quiet, woman!" when he slams the bedroom doors closed. And I think it really says something for the sequence that all three of us have actually chosen it as our favourite scene. But what makes it even more impressive is that, Dick, you say some of that was ad-libbed.
Well, also during that scene, apparently, Karen Gardner flashed the whole crew, so that probably gave him information number two.
That only adds to the enjoyment of it, doesn't it?
I will say, that scene when she's looking at him so longingly, the last time I saw any females in the Hammer films that we've done so far goes back to Dracula. Yeah, with Melissa Stripling looking like so longingly when she's thinking about the count, you know, and her encounter with him.
I do have a reserve favorite scene because I absolutely knew that Steve was going to take mine. The scene in the cave when the Baron discovers the beggar girl talking to his monster. I just love the quiet intensity of it, the slow build up. The Baron wakes up and he hears the beggar girl talking. I say talking in inverted commas because she's vocalizing. It's not really speech, but she's talking very quietly and very intently to something that we can't see just yet. It's just off camera. But I love the earnestness. You really get the impression that she's talking with her only friend in the world, because really, apart from the Baron and Hans, this poor woman's treated pretty appallingly by everyone else in the entire film. And then, as the Baron moves closer, we still don't see what she is communing with, but it's all in Cushing's facial expression, the way that his face changes. We just know that he's rediscovered his monster.
When he walks in, and the way Francis is photographing her, see, and she's kind of crouching down there and in the light, and the glow off of the ice, and it's a beautiful looking scene at that point. It's not necessarily a favorite overall scene, but when Cushing is talking to Zoltan, and he thinks that it's another policeman, and he's empty in that, that he makes a point of taking the nudie picture off the wall. He's going to put it in his suitcase, but no, he folds it up and sticks it into his pocket. I had not noticed that before. Well, to be honest, until Blu-ray, I didn't notice that was a nudie picture on the wall.
Good old Blu-ray.
Now, Dick, this might catch you a little bit by surprise, but we often have a segment which we call Meeting the Stars. Or I say we, it's actually Steve's. It's his chance to shine because it's Steve that gets to go to all those incredible conventions and be surrounded by a bevy of Hammer beauties. And I've usually got nothing. So we'd really love to hear about your recollections of meeting people who are associated with this particular film, and even perhaps some friendships that might have sprung up.
Well, the first one would be the makeup man, Roy Ashton. I wrote one of my first fan letters. I wrote my first fan letter to him and knew him his whole life until he died. I was acquainted with many, many Hammer films, but you just have a few that are actually friends. He was actually a friend. When I went to England, he picked me up at the airport in 1977. He was getting ready to go to Paris to work on a Pink Panther film, but he still picked me up there, took me out to eat, took me to Shepparton. My first wife and I, he and his wife, drove us all around Southern England. I knew Freddie Francis. He was virtually my first or second interview in Little Shop.
Wow.
I was at a convention, and some dipshit had him cornered with piles and piles and piles of stuff to be autographed. And he's kind of looking at me, because I knew Freddie, and I managed to intercede. He says, "Dick, what do I do in situations like that?" I said, "You tell him you'll sign two items, and you walk away." Yeah. I knew Anthony Hines, met him several times, very quiet, reticent man. I suspect I knew more people involved with it, but those two stand out. I came close to meeting Cushing, but he died. And he was ill before that. But it's like a Hammer fan's dream to say that you knew some of these people. And in my case, I love the fact that I knew the people behind the scenes more than I knew the actors. Not just somebody who came in and did a few lines and I admired on the screen, but I wanted to know who they were, and I got to know them.
Well, in your face, Steve. I'm only kidding.
Jeez, Al. I mean, what way to turn this dark.
Dick, I was wondering if you might be able to clarify something for me. Now, I've read Grease Paint and Gore. It's a fantastic book. And I have some understanding of what Roy Ashton went through when he was given this particular project and the pressures that he had to work under. I know that the result wasn't especially well received. How did he feel about it? Did he just shrug his shoulders and move on? Or was it something that bugged him and stayed with him?
He was never under contract with Hammer. He was only brought in like a month ahead of time.
Mm.
I can't think of any other film company in England who was doing these kind of elaborate makeups other than him. You got somebody Universal, even at Columbia. You got a whole makeup department. You might have months to prepare it.
Mm.
He had, I don't like to say, I think it was beyond his skill range. The one he designed was basically with a headpiece.
Yeah.
There was the chin is so noticeable. You can see the eyes sticking out from under the makeup. It was a poor choice. And I think he just come down to the end of, I got to come up with something. This is it. Hopefully it'll work. I mean, he moved on from that. And you can't be Curse of the Werewolf. So given the time, I think he just said, well, it was what it was. I did the best job I could under the circumstances. Nobody's ever going to insult him to his face. Say, yeah, your makeup stunk. Oddly enough, for somebody who is as good a cinematographer as Francis, he could have lit it better.
Agreed.
I really noticed the eyes last night watching the film, moving under a mask of what it looked like.
Mm.
It struck me this last time that it's kind of frustrating because I've seen pictures in Little Shop of Horrors of the bust, the maquette that Roy Ashton sculpted.
I saw that at his house. It was gorgeous.
Yeah, and you can see that it's a good, solid design. But on screen, I don't know, I think it's partially what you said, Dick, that it could have been lit an awful lot better. But it just struck me that because of that contrast between the really pale skin and the really dark eyes, the damn thing looks like a panda. You know, I think if it could have been maybe lit more interestingly, or perhaps if there had just been more pigmentation in the skin, in the forehead, the face, to lessen that contrast between the skin and the eyes, it could have worked better. I don't think it's a bad design by any means, and that's why I say it's frustrating. I think the concept was very, very nearly there. But for various reasons, most of them apparently time, it just didn't come off.
There are certain points, photographed correctly, is very impressive.
And
the new Little Shop of Horrors, you read the Dave Ells. I mean, he won an Academy Award. The makeup artist, Rick Baker and that, they have all this training, all this equipment. Someone like him or Phil Leakey, they had nothing. They just went in. They had no particular training for this. They had no particular skill. They sure did not have the materials. They just don't say, create a Frankenstein monster.
Yeah.
And it was beyond them. It was beyond their skills. It was beyond the physical media they had to work with.
Yeah.
The mask didn't help them to channel whatever facial expressions because of the way the mask was. So it makes it a little harder for a suit actor to be able to give a better performance, but also you got to go with what the script is. But he's also playing a creature that had been, I don't know how long alive before he froze. Then he'd been frozen for, 10 years? So there's trauma to the brain and things like that. So you're not expecting the creature to be fully functional. And I think you could see that in the performance.
With that headpiece and that, they talk about he didn't emote, say, the way Christopher Lee did in Curse. There really wasn't a lot to do. I thought he did fine.
Yeah, me too.
What was expected of him, this brute, like Steve said, with probably a little brain damage from all the time in the ice, he did fine. I can't see even another trained actor with that makeup and that storyline having done that much better.
Yeah, agreed.
Now, at this point, we have a bit of a special treat. I know that all three of us have been fortunate enough to be able to record with the very talented artist and makeup artist Whitney Koyatsu through the Decades of Horror podcast. Big shout out to those wonderful people. Last year, Steve and I were lucky enough to be able to discuss the various Hammer Frankenstein makeups with Whitney, and in this segment, she gives a very honest and impassioned analysis of the evil of Frankenstein creature. So take it away, Whitney.
I heard somewhere that it was because of the budget issues. And the thing is, if anything is cut, budgets are cut, and you take away from a makeup artist, it's gonna show. You can't take that from the artist and then challenge them to work on something similar to a different company or a different artist worked on, because it's just hard if the money's not there. But I heard that there were like bolts like used in this one, and there was like paper made, and there even a rag. And I'm like, man, I understand having to be creative. I understand needing to use things from home. I've had to do that before. I still do that. Homemade gelatins, things like that. But oh my gosh, like, I was really shocked that this was considered camera ready. I mean, it's a shame. There was an opportunity, but then when the money's not there, we're artists, we're not magicians. And I could dream here, I could see the struggle. Like, it's not like the artist didn't have a talent or the effort. I could see it, but I'm like, there's a budget. Man, you know, that's such a vital thing for making the magic happen. Like with any artist, if someone says like, hey, can you make me a cake? But yeah, but I need the ingredients. I'm gonna have to have, you know, the cake, the batter, all that good stuff. If something's missing, it can all go wrong.
Fascinating stuff there, I'm sure you'll agree, from an industry professional and a wonderful person. Thank you, Whitney. And now we come to one of our occasional segments, Dick, which is merchandise. Now, I really cannot think of a better item to discuss in relation to Evil of Frankenstein than Little Shop of Horrors, issue 49. And in fact, it's the main reason that we were really keen to have you join us to discuss this film. So, Dick, can you give us some idea of how this wonderful issue came together? Maybe a little bit of background, and how you feel about it all these months later.
I often look at a film, and doesn't even have to be a great film, because we did Bud Beast Terror and things like that. Do we have something new to be said about it? Is it just going to be a review? Because Little Shop, after the first reaches, was not going to be reviewing. It wasn't going to be me talking about horror Dracula, or Alistair talking about something, or Steve talking about something and writing a review. I wanted to know how the films were made. I wanted to know the background. I wanted a history of that background.
Yeah.
Evil of Frankenstein, I knew I was going to be finishing up the last two Frankensteins in the last couple issues. We hadn't covered it. And I was able to uncover a lot of information. Oh, see, I believe Katie Wells lives in Australia. And that's where we got that interview, which is actually a transcription of a video interview, because we were going to contact her and say, well, she's probably going to say the same thing she said in that, because it was 60 years ago and she's in her 80s now. It just seems like when I start an issue, one thing moves to another, and then I find out a guy, Sandor Ellis. That's cool. Then I find, oh yeah, I've got an interview with Karen Gardner. Well, that's cool. And then somebody at Hammer says, well, I've got these production files that survived. And it's like top tier, it just keeps growing. That's an American term. Topsy was a character that kept growing and growing. Anyway, this issue came out well. It started out not selling really well, but I guess the word has got around, and now it's back to where it used to be. And print magazines do not sell as well as they used to. It's just the way it is. The funny thing is, the harder to sell something, I think the better Little Shop of Horrors has got. Helps to find artists like Alistair Hughes can be sucking into working for me.
It's an honor.
I think it's an incredible publication. I mean, The Evil of Frankenstein was a film that I didn't think I held in particularly high regard. But reading all of these wonderful interviews and features which you've managed to bring together, Dick, into this beautiful issue, you can't help but have your appreciation added to by this piece of work. I really do think that it is the definitive coverage of Evil of Frankenstein. And any of you listening, if you want to know pretty much all there is to know about Evil of Frankenstein, then I cannot recommend Little Shop of Horrors, issue 49, highly enough.
Thank you.
It does also contain a little scribble from me, but please don't let that put you off.
The one good thing of being old, and I'm 76, is that I was young, the people were still alive. Mm. Virtually everybody involved at Hammer in the executive level, and most of the producers, they're all gone. All the producers, all the directors, all the screenwriters, they're all gone. And I was around at a time when I could contact. This is the days of snail mail. It's all back and forth. It's recording stuff and audio cassettes. And I looked back and then said, my goodness. Except for the Hammer Queens are now in their late 70s.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's alive anymore, but we capture their memories.
Yes, which is just so, so important. Now, I'm going to move on to my final thoughts, if that's okay with you both. I've never met a Hammer horror film I haven't liked, particularly one starring Cushing. But this one makes me work hard. However, I'll stay on the positive. The Baron is the most moralistic and emotionally stable version we've seen. And employing a body snatcher seems to be about as nefarious as he gets, which, you know, given that the film is called Evil of Frankenstein, is kind of ironic. Perhaps he has more in common with Cushing's performance in Frankenstein Created Woman than I realized. And although it's tempting to speculate that that might be a direct sequel to this sequel, there are many anomalies, including the fact that he changes hands, between this film and that one. But the point I'd like to make is that I really like the Baron's rapport with Sandor Elez Hans. It seems to be the most paternal relationship we've seen, or will see, and it carries us through the film well, including their brief appearance as a kind of 19th century Batman and Robin dynamic duo at the carnival. And I enjoy the rare moment of self-doubt that the Baron has when he asks Hans why he stays with him. And as I've mentioned, I really like Katie Wilde's performance as well. Semi-feral, yet innocent enough to see past the monster's appearance and show him kindness. She conveys her thoughts and emotions through facial expression and body language, and it's always compelling to watch. The budget all appears to be on screen, with Hammer's best laboratory set and generously populated crowd scenes. I just wish that some more of that money, or time, because in the film industry I understand it's pretty much the same thing, could have been spent on the all-important creature. When I watch a Hammer film featuring Cushing, he is usually an important foundation stone for the entire production, an important pillar in holding the whole thing up. But here, I wouldn't go as far as to say that he is the only reason that I'd watch Evil of Frankenstein, but the support that he gives the production is far more substantial in this film than any other that I can think of. But having said that, as I've explained, this film definitely has its good points, and like any Hammer Frankenstein, one that I am very happy to return to.
As I say, I agree with a lot of the thoughts that you set out. You pretty much took a lot of the things I was going to summarize if you hadn't, you know, done such an elegant job. But it's only fair since I always steal your favorite scene and will continue to do so. There's a lot of things I enjoy about this movie, as you brought up with the sets, the matte paintings, the acting that we brought up already, our favorite scene. I also enjoyed the scene where they're infiltrating the town, going for the carnival, and where the Baron is just not worried because, oh, there'll be so many people, nobody's going to notice us, which is so true because when you have a lot of people at a fair, nobody's really paying attention to somebody in a coach. And it just, you know, so the Baron was right about a lot of things, but I like how he was humble because he says, oh, Baron, you're right as usual. Because I'm not right about everything. So I enjoyed the camaraderie between the two of them. You can just tell that these are two traveling companions, co-workers that have been together for a while. And both actors did an excellent job portraying that. As I brought up before, there were some things I had questions about. And to me, the character Zoltan, the hypnotist, as we've already mentioned, was kind of an ill-fitting for a long-term character. I think it would have probably served better if he would have came in, got the creature's brain rebooted, and then left. It would have been interesting to see how they would have handled the script from that point on. But I think they wanted him to be the evil character, obviously, because in this movie, Frankenstein is not. And what I'm wondering, though, and hopefully you two guys can answer this, when Zoltan goes to the creature and says, I want you to find the Burgermeister. I want you to find the chief of police. Okay. The creature we know from the flashback in that thing has only been around for a very short period of time. As had been shot in the head, had been deep froze for a while, like 10 years. So we know he's not running on all cylinders. So even if he knew the people prior, how does he know where these people are, who these people are? I mean, I'm sure you could say, well, he whispered to him the one time and gave him all those instructions and directions. I have children. I can tell them, I can give them written directions, and I can tell you it's still 50-50 whether it's going to be done. And they're all college age or older. So considering the state the creature's in, I'm thinking you're giving them verbal instructions. How does he even understand? How could the creature find these people is a plot hole I think is unfillable. They could just have to let go unless you two can tell me that I missed something.
It's a movie because we don't have a clue.
Exactly. Yeah. I know it's a rhetorical question, and I know it's just a movie. So to me, if you can believe this creature could be made, I think when you go to watch Evil Frankenstein, the way to enjoy it the best is to go in and let it go. Let it flow. Don't hold it to the continuity. Enjoy the moments with Peter Cushing, especially we know what scene. I think it's a solid movie. Is it the best of the Frankenstein movies? I've seen four of them. Three of them we've done in Hammerama. Like we said, one with Monster Kid Radio. This would I put number four. But I'm not saying it is a bad thing. I think it's an enjoyable movie. And I'm going to have to seek out issue 49 to find out more background detail.
Every Hammer film is a classic. And once I hear someone say the Slave Girls, Prehistoric Women's Classic, I said, that word classic doesn't mean anything anymore. So it's got Hammer on it. They ain't all classic. Of all the Frankenstein films, it's the second to the bottom. But there's not a huge difference between the best, which I think is Revenge of Frankenstein, and to get to Evil. Or Frankenstein is just so different from the rest.
Yeah.
It's hard to even lump them into the group other than has the name Frankenstein in it. It was a kind of an end of an era. It was the end of the classic era of Hammer and Bray Studios. Those gorgeous exterior sets after the Gorgon would all be gone. In 1964, Hammer didn't make a film at Bray. They flattened their whole back line. They come back in 65 and 66, toned down stuff, but Hammer made great films at that, but it wasn't Hammerland anymore. It wasn't the same group of people anymore that went to film the film. And they certainly had wonderful films after that, like our upcoming The Devil Rides Home. It was that and the Gorgon. It was the end of an era. And that's not a bad way to end it.
That's a wonderful way to sum that up.
We do have feedback from our prior episode.
Do we?
Yes, we do. From Patrick. He emailed us, and people, you can email us at diecastmoviepodcast@gmail.com, at diecastmoviepodcast@gmail.com, and your feedback, too, could be read by either Al or myself. Hi, Steven. Just wanted to wish you all the best. I hope you're feeling better. I really enjoyed the reanimated Hammerama episode. It was already great fun, but you guys managed to make it even better. Scars is far from my favorite Hammer movie. But with any Hammer film, there are always interesting details to explore and great concepts that were perhaps a little undercooked or overutilized in the case of the infamous bat. Maybe the often talked about Toho-Hammer collaboration would have been a better opportunity to introduce a giant bat monster controlled by Dracula. Just think, it could have led to Dracula meets Godzilla. Anyway, I like that. You know, anything with Godzilla, you got me in. I mean, that's anyway, as always, looking forward to the next episode. Best wishes, Patrick.
Excellent feedback.
One of my friends is Roger Dickens, and he created the Bat and Stars of Dracula.
I actually tried to defend the Bat against Steve's relentless onslaught because Roger Dickens has done some amazing work.
A little bat goes a long way. A lot of that kind of bat doesn't help.
Hammer didn't, as a rule, do bats well, except in Vampire Circus, because they're real bats. I mean, the big bats in Bride of Dracula are not great. Universal's bats weren't always wonderful, but it's a tough one to pull off.
Well, as we've said, I don't think that many people can pull off bats particularly well. I think a whole generation probably grew up thinking that despondently flapping puppets were actually what real bats look like. Thank you, Patrick. That is excellent feedback, and as you can hear, certainly stimulated some more conversation. So, Steve, I guess it's time for you and I to decide which film we're going to cover next month.
So we're about to roll the die to see what our next movie is going to be. For listeners that don't remember, one is Dracula, two is Frankenstein, three is The Mummy, four is science fiction, five is prehistoric, and six is what, Alex?
Number six is the experimental 1970s.
Alistair's favorite number is six. But let me roll the die. And we rolled a four. We're going back to science fiction.
Steve's favorite category, we are going sci-fi. And I think, Steve, it would be a good idea for us to rejoin Professor Q. So next month, we are going to talk about the remaining Hammer Quatermass film, Quatermass 2.
Or I might have seen it one time. I'll find out when I watch it. I knew I own it on Blu-ray.
The Quatermass first two lightly covered in one of my very early, number six or seven. It's my regret that we didn't get to them, but when it finally dawned on me, the end of Count's Little Shop, there's just no room. But we did Quatermass in the Pit, number 40. Love to have done X the Unknown, but it just didn't work out. I got too old too fast. I'll always be involved in this. I just won't be publishing and doing my own stuff anymore. We're going to have The Damned, which is, or These Are Damned. One that's got a big article on that. We're going to end on Horror Frankenstein and The Abominable Snowman. It's an interesting double combination in the last issue.
Snowman is one of my favorite Hammer films.
Dick, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a real honor and privilege and delight for Steve and I to have you on our little podcast. We've definitely benefited from your knowledge and experience. Thank you so much again.
Well, thank you. This was a lot of fun. A lot of Hammer fans in Des Moines, Iowa. My wife, of course.
We're glad you could join us.
All right.
Yeah.
And listeners, we genuinely hope that you have enjoyed this as much as we have. Our third time lucky attempt to cover Evil of Frankenstein with Mr. Richard Clemenson. And please join us next month when we go all sci-fi and rejoin Professor Q for Quatermass 2.
Hammerama is a proud part of the Diecast Movie Podcast.